Hello and welcome to The Leap of Faith. Well, it's been a week where we heard of the dreadful loss of life in Philadelphia in the US when, armed with an assault rifle and handguns, a man shouted anti-Semitic insults and opened fire inside a Pittsburgh synagogue last Saturday morning, killing 11 people and wounding 4 police officers and 2 others. The assailant, identified as Robert B. Bowers, is in custody and has been indicted before a grand jury on 44 counts in connection with the attack. As the centenary of the armistice approaches, a new art installation at St. Patrick's Cathedral in Dublin has opened. It features 36,000 leaf-shaped messages hung from the cathedral's ceiling, remembering the 36,000 Irish men and women who died in World War I. Tomorrow, Saturday, November 3rd, is All Survivors Day, when for the first time in the history of the Catholic Church, protesters from around the world will make a call for transparency and atonement to survivors of clerical sexual abuse. People are expected to gather at regional locations throughout the world, including Dublin, at 3 o'clock tomorrow. People Before Profit TD Breed Smith has criticised the Roman Catholic Church for asking parishioners for donations to foot a €4 million debt from the World Meeting of Families. The visit of Pope Francis to Ireland cost the state an estimated €19.4 million. That's according to parish newsletters, but only €15.4 million has been raised for the event so far. Parishes have listed Sunday, November 11th, as the World Meeting of Family collection date at Masses. Reports that a group of people dressed as Ku Klux Klan members posed outside an Islamic prayer house in Northern Ireland are being investigated as a hate crime. Images circulating on social media purport to show individuals dressed as members of the far-right group in Newtownards, County Down, last Saturday evening. Every single one of the 40 constituencies in Ireland voted to remove the word blasphemous from Article 40.6.1 of the Constitution in last week's referendum. Executive Director of Amnesty Ireland, Colm O'Gorman, has said that states like Pakistan can no longer justify their own severe anti-blasphemy laws by pointing to Ireland's constitution. Meanwhile, Pakistan's top court on Wednesday acquitted a Christian woman who was sentenced to death under the country's controversial blasphemy laws. Asha Bibi, who has been on death row since 2010, is a Catholic mother of 5 and has been held at an undisclosed location for security reasons and is expected to leave the country for her own safety. Rupert Sheldrake is a biologist and author of more than 85 scientific papers and 13 books. He studied natural science at Cambridge University, where he is a scholar of Clare College, took a double first-class honours degree and was awarded the University Botany Prize in 1963. He then studied philosophy and history of science at Harvard University and was in Dublin this week, where he spoke on the topic of science and spiritual practices, which is also the title of his latest book. Rupert, welcome to Ireland. Our programme is called The Leap of Faith. You may ask us to make a number of leaps of faith over the next couple of minutes. But can I start by asking you the idea of science and spirituality coming together? Are they mutually exclusive?
No, not at all. I mean, what I'm talking about in my book is 7 different spiritual practices which have measurable scientific effects. So it's actually not a leap of faith at all. It's a measurable effects. For example, in meditation, there are measurable physiological effects and measurable effects on health and well-being of people who meditate. So we're not talking a leap of faith that this is changing people. It's something scientifically investigated.
So there's a basis of good common sense in most religious practices. Would that be the thesis?
Yes, that the most religious practices have effects that you can now find out scientifically. I mean, singing and chanting, for example, have effects on the people who are doing it. If you're doing it with others, they bring their physiological breathing and heartbeat even into synchrony. So there's all these are scientifically measurable facts. They're not a matter of blind belief or faith at all.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that faith then, because what I hear you saying is that if you follow these 7 practices, and we'll enumerate them in a moment, that you won't do yourself any harm.
No, none of them will do you any harm. None of the ones I'm talking about in this book.
And then these are meditation, gratitude, connecting with nature, relating to plants, I want to look at that in a moment, rituals, singing and chanting, and pilgrimage and holy places. Let's set the story back a little bit, because your training is in biology and in science.
Yes.
Would you have a faith yourself?
I do. I've been through various phases. I started out with a normal Christian background in England. Then by about the age of 14, as part of my scientific education, I became an atheist and remained one for years. I mean, science, when I was educated in England, meant atheism. They went together. It was a package deal, at least the way it was presented to me. Then I began to doubt the science. That was my first doubts about mechanistic science. Is nature really a machine? Are plants and animals really machines? Am I just a machine? I began to doubt all that. And then through travelling in India and working in India for 7 years, I was exposed to Asian religions, Hinduism, meditation, pilgrimage. I had a Sufi practice for a while, and then I was drawn back to a Christian path. I spent 2 years in an ashram in South India with Father Bede Griffiths, who was a Benedictine monk. And so when I got back to England after all that, I actually returned to my religious roots. And so now I'm a practicing Anglican.
Scientist.
I'm a scientist.
A practicing Anglican scientist, I suppose, what I was teasing out there a little bit, because we really should examine further the idea that as part of your scientific training, there was almost an expectation that you would lose your faith.
Oh, yes, it was taken for granted. In fact, it was considered, you know, almost impossible for anyone who was reasonable, rational, and scientifically minded to believe in things that were considered stupid, the resort of the feeble-minded or the chronically fearful. And it was considered a kind of psychopathology to have religious faith.
Now, you suggested in one of your books, The Science Delusion, that science is currently operating under a number of delusions. You're having a swipe at scientists there.
Well, the point is that science itself has become excessively dogmatic. The traditional critique of religion is it's about dogma. And actually, that's not really the case anymore. Being religious is such a minority pursuit now in most parts of Europe that it's not kind of blind dogma for most people. They're well aware that this is considered eccentric by most of their friends. Science, on the other hand, has become extraordinarily dogmatic, and in the 10 dogmas of contemporary science are what I examine in my book, The Science Delusion. I examine them by turning them into questions and seeing how well they hold up scientifically. So I won't go through all the dogmas, but the kinds of things are that nature's a machine, nature's mechanical, matter's unconscious, the mind is nothing but the activity of the brain, it's all inside your head. Memories are stored in the brain. Mechanistic medicine is the only kind that really works. All the alternative therapies.
Okay, well, let's play with one of those for the moment, which is the idea that memories happen in the brain, and what we're seeing is a reflection of nerves being agitated by light. Mm. You take a different perspective on that.
I think the brain's more like a tuning system, more like a TV set than a video recorder. I think we tune into our memories by a process I call morphic resonance. And I'm not the only person. Quite a number of philosophers have suggested memory is not stored in the brain. That's not how it works. Most scientists just dogmatically assume it must be. How else could it possibly work? Now, I think a lot of this scientific faith is actually misplaced. I think many people assume that all spiritual practices are based on blind dogma or faith. Not the case at all. They're based on experience. And what comes first there is experience, not belief.
I'm curious because if you look at any of the faiths, and we've done that many times in the programs here, simple idea of fasting would have been introduced as part of the dogma. And it would have been introduced because it was actually very good for the population that were following it. It wasn't based on any faith principles.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, certainly it was used traditionally in shamanic societies. In the Old Testament, Moses and Elijah fasted. Jesus, of course, fasted for 40 days in the desert. And in American vision quests, they fast. It's partly because fasting induces a change in the chemistry of the blood. The ketone bodies that occur, the beta-hydroxybutyric acid is one of them that occurs in fasting, very closely related to gamma-hydroxybutyric acid, which is a neurotransmitter.
So you have a religious experience as
a result of it. You have a religious experience.
And my point being that it didn't come necessarily from a god, the idea to this. This was a man-made direction.
A discovery. A discovery through fasting. It may have been come about through simply lack of food to start with, but what people found was that it changes your ability to concentrate and often facilitates prayer or other spiritual practices.
Why should we relate to plants as part of our well-being?
Our ancestors were hunter-gatherers, and unless they knew about plants, they simply couldn't survive. Then they settled and became agriculturalists, and their whole life revolved around them. And even today, the most popular pastime, at least in Britain, is gardening. Now, it's very, very deep in our nature. And in traditional societies, when people cut down the forest for agriculture, they left patches in their wild state, which became sacred groves. And the sacred groves were refuges for the wild animals, but also for the spirits of the land, and they thought in terms of the natural spirits living there. India still has thousands of sacred groves, and it's where you can find the most endangered species because no one's ever cut them down or destroyed them. Europe does. One of the greatest ones in Europe is at the Saint-Baume in the south of France, around the cave of St. Mary Magdalene, an ancient forest. And what's happened now is that sacred groves have been rebranded national parks, particularly in the United States, like Yellowstone and so on.
You'll find a few of them in Ireland called fairy forts. So yes. The same idea is there. I suppose what we're exploring with you is that you're saying that there are a number of things that even if you are atheist, or agnostic, or of no particular faith, that if you follow these principles, there's an outcome. What is that outcome?
The outcome of most of these spiritual practices is to feel that you're part of something greater than yourself, that you feel connected. You feel connected with nature, for example, through being in among trees, in forests or outdoors. And many people, even as children, have this sense of a connection with something greater than themselves. Through meditation, you can feel when your own chain of internal dialogue dies down that your mind is part of something greater than your own. Through singing and chanting, you feel connected and linked to those you're singing and chanting with. And if you're chanting sacred chants, then you link in with the whole tradition of people who've done them before. All these practices are ones that give the experience of being part of something greater than yourself. And the spiritual experience is really about that. It's about feeling you're not just an isolated mind inside an isolated brain in the privacy of your skull, but that you're part of something much bigger. And it's usually joyful and it's usually helpful. It makes people happier and healthier. Actually, people who do these practices are measurably happier and healthier than those that don't.
You have a rather nice ritual that you carry out with your godson.
I have a teenage godson, yes, who's now 18. And when he was 14, I didn't know what to give him for his birthday, which is in June. And I've stopped giving people stuff because everyone's got too much stuff. So I give experiences. And I've got very interested in this revival of pilgrimage that's going on in Europe at the moment. So I suggested to him, I'll offer you this, a pilgrimage. We take a train to a village near Canterbury. We walk the last 8 or 9 miles through fields and meadows on a footpath. We go to an ancient healing well. Then we go to Canterbury Cathedral. We walk around it, circumambulate to make it the centre. We go in like candles at the Shrine of St. Thomas. Then we have a cream tea. And then we go to choral evensong. And then we go home. And I said, would you like to do that? And without hesitation, he said, yes. And we had an absolutely blissful day. When he was 15, we went to Ely Cathedral, walking along the River Cam, 16 Lincoln, 17 Wells, 18 this year, Winchester Cathedral. The same general formula. And it's one of the highlights of my whole year, and I think his. And it's the most wonderful thing to do. And because going on a pilgrimage is deeply archetypal. Every culture, every religion has pilgrimages. Every country has its sacred places. And what's interesting in Europe at the moment is the old footpath routes are being reopened. Pilgrim paths in Ireland, for example, there's now 11 different pilgrim paths being reopened here. And in Britain, the same's going on.
A lot of people would maybe want to carry out some of these particular activities, but they are still resonating a certain anger towards how religion has let them down, or at least the humans within the faith of religion have let them down. How do you square that away?
Well, I mean, I can understand that some people have good reasons to be angry. Most people I know don't have very good reasons to be angry about religion. I mean, when I became an atheist, it wasn't because I'd been abused or I'd been treated extremely well by religious people. I mean, I had no personal complaint at all. Some people have been badly treated, but a lot of people who become atheists do so because they think science has disproved religion or it's stupid to believe in these things. Now, for people who feel angry, I think it would be a great shame if their anger about their personal experience blocks off all these spiritual practices, because these practices are about connection. They help us. And some of the practices I talk about in my book, like walking in nature, connecting with sacred groves and trees, actually have almost nothing to do with traditional religious practice. So those are ones that presumably would not trigger off the anger response. And some of the others, like meditation, you know, ones that anyone can practice at home. And so the rituals are one of the practices that I think are very important. All cultures have them. And I think they're important for a sense of connection. But again, if you don't like the rituals of one particular tradition, then there are rituals of other ones. And some rituals, like the American Thanksgiving dinner, are not particularly religious, but they're still rituals. So it would be a shame to lose all these practices out of anger, I think.
It's interesting that different faiths have requirements of their members. Some ask the members to educate themselves and to read scripture and to be aware of it. And others have one that they take things on blind faith. Yours has got a basis of test, validate. You're using your scientific training.
Well, exactly. That's because I don't actually see a conflict between science and spiritual experiences. Both of them are about experience. Science is empirical, and the word empirical means experience. And spiritual experiences are experiences. So there's no inherent conflict at all between them. Once you get to the actual experiences and the practices, then you find religions have a great deal in common with each other. And these practices actually work for many people and have measurable effects.
Well, you can read more about that in the book Science and Spiritual Practices, the author, Dr. Rupert Sheldrake. Thank you for joining us on The Leap of Faith.
Thank you.
Next this evening, we'll leave the studio and take you to the north side of Dublin, not far from the River Liffey, to Stanhope Street. And we're in the Sanctuary, founded in 1998 by Sister Stanislaus Kennedy. It's a place of contemplation and meditation. And there we find Sister Stan is going to take me on a mini tour of this inner city haven.
We're here now in the garden of the sanctuary. There are three gardens. There's a garden here on my left, that's for movement. In that garden, if the weather is good, we would do maybe Tai Chi and yoga. And particularly it is used for walking meditation. Then on my right is more the floral garden, which again is circular. And then that's used for walking or for sitting and enjoying the ambience of the place. And we have there a little pond, you can hear the water. And in it we have fish that have been here from the beginning. So again, that is to help people find stillness, to find that serenity.
I'm curious about somebody like yourself who works very hard. I don't think there's any denying that. But do you practice what you encourage others to do? How do you find your own peace in here?
Oh yeah, I find this very peaceful. But I do practice, of course, meditation and contemplation. And for me it is a very important part of my life. I really know that I couldn't have done what I have done or do what I am doing without having that centre of peace within me and my spending time there. And the sanctuary, while I'm not here, of course, all the time, I'm here often in the early in the morning, or I'm here in the evening when I come back from working in the city or whatever I am. And it is a very restful and very beautiful place.
Now, you've captured the way a monastery measures its day. Tell us a little more about the idea of hours.
I suppose the monastic life always appealed to me, even though I am an active religious, but I suppose our founder Mary Aiken had said we were to be contemplatives in action. And I suppose I would have in the past have visited monks and nuns who lived the monastic life. And if I stayed in any of them, I was always touched by the hours and the place they had in the monks' or nuns' lives. And I just felt that it made sense that there would be times during the day that we would stop and that we would at least reflect, if not pray and contemplate. And it does really mark the day, mark different parts of the day. It is much more than a trigger that reminds us. It is a really a deepening of our life, and using the hours as a way of going deeper into our inner life, and it then flowing over and permeating the rest of our lives.
Because modern life has us not only living by the hour, but we're living by the minute and the second sometimes. But the monastic world didn't work that way.
That's true. And I suppose what I think about it and is that with an active life like my own, or lay people particularly, I think there is a way of bringing that into their lives. And I suppose that's what I've tried to do myself, and that's what I would like to offer to others.
I'm interested about the comparison of the two, because if you just looked at the monastic life as it was, there was mindfulness there, there was meditation there, but they probably weren't labelled that way.
No, they weren't. And the early fathers and mothers of the desert talked about mindfulness as attentiveness. That was the word that was used. And they talk about presence, and that meaning the presence of God. And that was very much being in the present moment and being mindful. And I suppose there is a view amongst many that mindfulness is a Buddhist practice, and it comes from the Buddhists. Certainly the word does come from Buddhism, but that's the word. I think the practice of it dates back to all faiths. All faiths have this attentiveness or this mindfulness or this presence a very much part of their life.
There'll be many people listening to us this evening who've tried a bit of mindfulness or tried a bit of meditation and walked away from it in desperation or frustration.
Yeah, I think that's true. And the only thing I can say to them is stay with it. If you decide I'm going to meditate for 5 minutes or for 10 minutes, stay with it. Don't stand up after 3 or 4 minutes that this isn't working. Stay with it for the time. And there's no way of doing it. There's no way of learning how to do it except with practice.
When did you first come across this? You took a sabbatical from your work and were introduced for the first time to meditative practices.
Yeah, that was way back in 1992, I think. I took a sabbatical and I went to Berkeley in California. And I then came across the whole practice of meditation, of contemplation, of mindfulness, Pilates, Tai Chi, yoga, all these things. And I found them all very centering.
Well, I was going to say, as a Kerry woman in California, how did it pass the test of sincerity, of authenticity, that it was a real thing and not flim-flam?
I found it a real thing. I think it depends on where you're coming from. If I didn't have my own faith and if I didn't have my own practices beforehand, maybe I would have been carried away and ended up with something that was very empty. Mm. But I allowed it to build on what I already had. So it complemented it and it deepened it for me. You know, other people would say, you know, that the two are conflictual. I don't think so.
Well, now we've moved indoors, mindful of the fact that it was getting a little bit chilly outside. And Sister Stan, you have a new book which you've brought out called Awakening Inner Peace. What was the thinking behind putting this together?
The thinking behind it was, I was talking to you earlier about the importance of the monastic life and the hours. And I wanted really to do something, to write something that would really have meaning for everyone, not just for priests and religious, but for everyone, in the sense that would help them to realise the importance of stopping, stopping during the day at different times. They don't necessarily have to follow the hours, the monastic hours, which are in this book, but at any time during the day to stop, to reflect. And what I have in this book is, I have a little verse from a psalm, and then I have a poem of my own and a prayer. They're all linked together, and they are. It is laid out just like the Book of Hours. So I would say very strongly that I intended it for lay people, particularly, for whom there is very little really by way of helping people to reflect, to pray. So that's what I had in mind. I think this little book, I would put it on my desk, and I would open it during the day and read it and reflect on it. You know, so it's. That's how I see it. I think the monastics have their own way of life, which is absolutely fantastic. I think it's a wonderful way of life. It's not my way of life. I wouldn't be drawn to it. But I do really believe that I, as well as everybody else, do need times to stop, times to pause, times to give thanks, and times to recognise that we are in the hands of God.
We hear from the various different wellness experts that are out there that we should have 1 hour before bed, no technology. I'm interested in thinking that this might actually replace that space.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, and I would say that about my own life, that, you know, technology has taken over the lives of many people. Technology is very good in itself, but it's not good that it's taken over people's lives. So I think if people can build in to their lives time to stop, times to pause. But people find it hard. I mean, I say I teach meditation here night week in the sanctuary, and I say to them, you know, if you could stop for 1 minute every few hours, just 1 minute, and breathe mindfully, or just remember you're in the presence. And they tell me they would find it, they'd start, and they couldn't even do it for the minute. Yeah. It's a practice. It's like a muscle. You train the muscle. It's the very same thing with opportunities to stop, to pause, to pray, to meditate. This is one I'd like to share with you. The book is broken up into weeks, 4 weeks, and then there are the different hours during each day of the week. So this one is for the second week, and this is Tuesday. And it starts with a verse of a psalm, and then there is a verse of my own, and then a prayer. So the psalm: the Lord's is the earth and its fullness, the world and all its peoples. It is God who set it on the seas, who made it firm on the waters. That's Psalm 24. And then my verse is: dawn, before the clatter of the day, in silence, in solitude, we hear a new day birthing in us, around us. Out of silence, the chant of Lords opens our heart, quietens our mind, restores our senses as we enter the day with new focus. And then the little prayer is, the Lord is the earth and its fullness. Come, let us adore.
The book is called Awakening Inner Peace, a little book of hours. Sister Stan, thank you for joining us on The Leap of Faith.
You're welcome, Michael. Thank you.
And that's The Leap of Faith for this week. From all of us here tonight, good night.